been listening to Another Green World on WORT 89.9 FM and HD, Madison Back Porch Broadcasting.
Thanks so much for listening. Have a great week, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Russia has announced plans to develop new land-based missile systems in response to US decision to abandon an arms control treaty. Moscow has also pulled out of the Intermediate Range Pact, raising fears of a new arms race. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports.
The US says Russia already has land-based cruise missiles. The reason why Washington said it was pulling out of the INF treaty. But Moscow's latest announcement will add to the concerns of a new arms race. Russia's defense minister said work will begin on developing two new missile systems within 2 years. One will be based on the Kalibr cruise missile already used by the Russian Navy. Moscow said it will also be developing a land-based hypersonic missile, which could travel 5 times the speed of sound.
Apple has reached a deal with France to pay back more than a decade's worth of taxes. French media say the company settled the case last December, handing over nearly $600 million. Here's our business correspondent, Jonty Bloom.
Each country's tax system is different. One reason they've had huge difficulty dealing with the international technology and online giants which have emerged in recent years. France believes the long-term solution is an EU-wide tax on such companies, but it's likely to face opposition, not least from countries like Ireland. Apple said in a statement that it knew the important role taxes played in society, and it paid its taxes in all the countries where it operated.
The president of the Central African Republic, Faustin Touadéra, has signed a peace deal with 14 rebel groups, aiming to end 6 years of conflict in which more than 1 million people have been forced from their homes. The ceremony took place in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, and was attended by President Omar al-Bashir. The African Union announced that a deal had been reached over the weekend. The actor Liam Neeson has said he's not racist after earlier confessing that he once set out to kill any black man to exact revenge. In a US television interview, he said he had been referring to his response when a friend told him she'd been raped by a black man. Neeson said he would have reacted the same, whatever the rapist's race or nationality.
If she'd have said an Irish or a Scot, or a Brit, mm-hmm. or a Lithuanian, I would have had the same effect. I was trying to show honour to my stand-up for my dear friend in this terrible medieval fashion. And I'm a fairly intelligent guy, and that's why it kind of shocked me when I came down to earth after having these horrible feelings.
You're listening to the World News from the BBC. Iran has warned Israel that if it continues attacking targets in Syria, Tehran will retaliate. Iran's National Security Council Secretary Ali Shamkhani said there would be a firm response that would teach the Israelis a lesson. Israel regards Iran as a major threat, and it has repeatedly carried out air attacks on sites in Syria associated with the Iranian military. The leaders of NATO's two most fractious allies, Greece and Turkey, are meeting in Ankara in a bid to improve relations. It's the second visit in 4 years by the Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras for talks with the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Ankara wants the exploration of oil and gas reserves around the divided island of Cyprus suspended until a political settlement can be found to guarantee Turkish Cypriots a fair share. The British Prime Minister Theresa May has given assurances in Northern Ireland that she's absolutely committed to avoiding a return to a hard border with the Irish Republic. She will meet the European Commission President in Brussels on Thursday. Here's Jonathan Blake.
Theresa May told reporters in Belfast she was not proposing to persuade people to accept a deal that didn't contain an insurance policy for the future. Some took that to suggest the backstop, designed to keep an open border between Northern Ireland and the Republic in all circumstances, would stay as part of her Brexit deal in some form. But later, Downing Street confirmed Mrs. May was still considering alternative arrangements, as well as a possible exit clause or time limit, and that urgent work was continuing on all options.
Police in Sweden say that priceless royal treasures, which were stolen last July, may now have been recovered. The thieves took two crowns and a knob, belonging to the 17th century monarchs Carl IX and Queen Christina. Local media reports suggest the regalia was found on top of a rubbish bin in Stockholm. BBC News.
Because she deserved the very best, you gave her what Car and Driver magazine called the finest luxury sedan of the new millennium. 18 years later, you both need it gone. WORT can help you turn that rusting chariot into the gift that lasts forever. Listener-sponsored community radio. Call 256-2001 or go to WORTFM.org to find out how.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal.
Hello and welcome to A Public Affair. It's Tuesday, so that means you've got me. I'm Carousel Baird. And it's not a snowstorm outside, so I'm actually showing up to the job today. I hope everyone survived last week. Sorry I missed you, but I'm very happy to be here today. And we are going to continue our great conversations with candidates on the ballot. The election, the primary election, is just 2 weeks from today. I can't remember the date. I'm sure the two people in our sitting here with me will remind me what the date is. But it's 2 weeks from today is the election. We've talked with many of the mayoral candidates, and I want to start our conversation today talking with our two school board candidates running for seat three. And it's a primary. There's only two that are running. One person dropped off, but they will be on the ballot in 2 weeks. The two candidates I have joining me today, Kaleem Kerr is here. Hello, Kaleem.
How you doing?
Wonderful. Great to have you. And hello, Chris.
Good
Chris Carusi.
Here.
Hi, Carousel.
Hello. I'm so glad both of you are running. I really appreciate and respect the hard work that both of you do. So I just want to sort of lay that out there. Sometimes,
you know,
candidates Thanks. Run for office, and I, of course, want to interview everyone and have a conversation. But I struggle sometimes with, geez, what questions am I going to ask this person? This person really doesn't have experience in their field. And that is absolutely not the case with both of you for different reasons, but both of you are passionate, and I have complete confidence that both of you would do the best that you could for all the students in MMSD. So just thank you both for running and being a part of politics to make our community a better place. You make a difference. So
thank you.
I want to put that out there. And I want to remind everyone, when you're interacting with great candidates, to thank them, to encourage them to run, and encourage maybe yourself to run one day if you have that aspiration and that hope. Not against us, though. Not run against all of us. All right. Well, I want to start a little bit MMSD. Let's just get the facts out there. 27,000 students plus. More than 50% are students of color. There are 32 elementary schools, 12 middle schools, and 6 high schools altogether, including the alternative schools. There are also many other pieces that we'll talk about it. But let's just start with sort of the basics. Chris, can you kick us off? Why are you running for school board?
I'm running for school board because I believe that every child in our community has the right to a world-class education in their local public school. I believe in the power of public schools and public education to close gaps and foster justice and equity. And I believe that public education is a cornerstone of democracy. Our schools need to do more than just prepare kids for college and career, although those things are both really important. We also need to prepare all of our kids for citizenship in a democratic society. I got to see Eve Ewing when she was in town a few weeks ago, and one of her takeaways that I really took to heart is that public schools are the only public institution we have that at least has the potential to give every single child a chance at a better future. However, if you look at the glaring opportunity and achievement gaps in Madison, we're not living up to that potential, and we've got to do better. I'm also running on my track record as a public education advocate. I've been going to school board meetings for about a dozen years, which I know is really nerdy, but I have been. During that time, I've been listening to members of our community and doing a lot of grassroots organizing for public education. In 2012, in the aftermath of Act 10, a group of us at Crestwood Elementary School started a group called SCAPE, or School Community Alliance for Public Education. And our goal was to become the public education advocacy group for Madison, which is what we've become. And we've had a lot of wins. We've stood up and we've protected Ready, Set, Goal conferences, which are a really essential parent-teacher conference at the beginning of the school year. We passed a budget amendment to reduce class sizes at high-poverty elementary schools. We worked with the district to craft a really strong wellness policy. We fought for more funding for special education assistance. So this is the kind of work I've been doing in the district for a while, and I want to put that experience to work on the board, so that's why I'm running.
Fantastic. Thank you, Chris. Kaleem.
Yes.
So good to have you. Tell us about why you're running for the school board.
So I ran 20 years ago, 1998, and long time in between now and then. But, you know, my focus on education hasn't changed in the 25 plus years that, you know, I really started working on education issues in Madison. First and foremost, I'm running because, you know, we should have the best school system in the country. We are always looking at those number one scores for our city, and in many ways we deserve those. But, you know, some of us feel that we're not as quite deserving because the results of a lot of our students, particularly students of color, don't succeed in Madison schools, and they should, and they can. The second reason is that, you know, this is my life's vocation. I am absolutely dedicated to ensuring that education becomes the pathway to success for all children. It is the gatekeeper to success for young people in this country, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. But when you realize that, and you look at the data and you see that for African American students, for example, less than 10% of them are reading at grade level by fifth grade, that's not good. And when you have less than 20% of Latino kids reading at grade level, it's not good. And when you have less than 70% of white children reading at grade level, that's not good. Mm-hmm. And it's not an indictment of the teachers in the schools so much as what we're doing. We're not keeping pace with the type of innovation and how it's affecting our children's learning outside of school. You know, the gap has grown. There are children who, if they are very voracious learners and have a strong appetite for learning, those children in our world, when I was a textbook dependent kid, where we got the textbook and the teacher took us through it over a year, now a child who's really interested in a subject can go home, look at a few YouTube videos, watch some, you know, some documentaries and read enough stuff online where over a weekend they could cover that whole curriculum that a teacher was teaching them. And they're in the same classroom with children on the other end who don't have access or the same appetite for learning. And teachers are required to move all those kids forward. But then we have tests and all these other things that weigh down on teachers where they have to focus on bringing the bottom up. So the kids at the middle, the kids at the top often don't get all that they need either. So we're spreading ourselves way too thin or across too much, and we're requiring too much. We're not focused enough on what needs to happen. So I'm here to try to help us focus. And lastly, you know, a lot of the things that the Madison School District does, I was involved with. I was the one that convinced the Latino community to start Nuestro Mundo for the sole purpose that dual language, which is something they aspired to have, would spread in the Madison School District, and it's done that. The Schools of Hope program was built around a program that Mimi Block, a former professor at the university, and I put together years ago. I was the one that convinced the UW to start People Program, which, you know, several hundred students have graduated from Madison schools, have graduated from the UW. And I left and I came back. But in the time I was gone, I've served on the panel that advised the U.S. Congress on No Child Left Behind. I was the only person from Wisconsin that was one of the expert reviewers for President Obama's Race to the Top initiative that he announced here at Wright Middle School in 2009. And I was, my role was to help seed the success of education, the three-sector initiative in Washington, D.C., and really organize the community around that. So I have a lot to bring to the table, and I just feel like now it's my time to step up and do more here back at home.
How do we, you both have touched on some similar themes. Before we get into the nitty-gritty, and there are a bunch of, you know, details that I want to talk about, behavioral education plan, access to food, homelessness, teacher sustainability, all of that. But I want to start with sort of a big picture question of, we are a society that is, and a city that is dealing with huge levels of poverty, huge levels of instability, huge levels of housing shortage and homelessness, that kids every day are walking into that building before anyone has taught anything, that are hungry, that don't have access to health care, let alone mental health care, let alone dental health care, that don't have access to families that can have stable housing, can have stable jobs, can have resources, that didn't have access to all the things that, you know, I don't know anything about parenting, I like to say. And yet I somehow my kid, when she showed up in kindergarten, both of my daughters, they were ahead of other kids that showed up in kindergarten. Me not knowing anything because I have a college degree and used vocabulary words and all these things. So here they are, the kids show up and all these barriers. And it's sort of overwhelming at the foolish thought, I will use the word foolish, that the schools can solve this. And yet here we are needing the schools to solve this. How do you address that? Colleen, do you want to go first on this one?
Yeah, sure. You know, I take an ecosystem model. I tell people to education. Part of my, when I mentioned my role in D.C., it was to try to bring together the spirit forces in the city to try to get education moving forward. Because number one, people wouldn't move back into the city. And our mayor, Anthony Williams, at the time wanted to increase the density of population in the city to overcome some of the economic challenges, taxation and things like that. They were tax poor in the city. And he knew schools were a big part of that. One of the things that we did to address that issue was bringing together Republicans, Democrats, I mean, a wide range of people, and not focus on the division, but focus on the singular purpose of developing a school system that will provide a plethora of options for young people. In Madison, that ecosystem that I think we need to look at is both inside and without outside of school. We've designed our school, One City Schools, around this very concept. So you brought up the issue of a number of things, housing, dental care, all of those things. I am of the belief that our schools need to operate like traditional black schools did in the South and, you know, the early part of the 20th century when blacks who were coming out of slavery, out of sharecropping, out of Jim Crow, are still living in those situations. They needed a lot more than a typical school than that we're used to in the North provides, where you just go to school and your teacher teaches you. There was more of an extension of your family. And so the type of schools I think we could create in Madison, just to give you an example, you know, we just had a dental cleanings at our school today for our children. They're going there right now. If you walked over there, they're going down in groups of 3 and 4, getting their teeth cleaned and teeth checked. And we do it 2 times a year at our school, no cost to our parents. We have a partnership with Access Community Health and Madison Dental Association, and they do that work for us. We have a full-time chef at our school who cooks healthy meals. So when I left there to come here, they were being served lunch. They have a hot breakfast, hot lunch every day, no canned goods, no refined sugar. Everything is fresh because we know that part of what drives our kids' success is their diet. We could be doing that in the Madison schools, and we're trying to come up with the financial model for that so we can share with other schools. How much does that cost? Housing, we work with YWCA. We work with Porch Light and Salvation Army when we've had families fall homeless when they've been with us, or families who come to us in those dire situations. We've helped families get jobs. You know, we have two parents who are PhDs, and there was a lot of stress in the family because one had a job in another community, in another state in New York, and the other one got a tenureship here. But because the trailing spouse system broke down after Scott Walker was elected, they couldn't get a job for her. So we stepped up, used our resources to help get a job to keep that family intact because we knew the stress of the child.
Your answers seem to make me think that you believe there are solutions to this that exist.
That's why I'm running for the school board.
You think the solutions actually exist?
The solution is the ecosystem that our kids grow up in has to be strong inside and outside of schools. We are getting it wrong when we look at the school as an independent entity and say, well, why aren't our kids succeeding when we send them there? There's a lot more that those children need to come to school with and go back home to at the same time. Well, all we're doing at our school is showing how that can be done. Mm-hmm. And I bought some results that we just got back from our kids' results. It shows that all but one of our kindergartners who have been in our school for a year exceeded the benchmarks for kindergarten readiness, all but one. Okay. But when you look at all of our kids who are in 4K, which most of them are new, most of them aren't near benchmark at all. But okay. It's the combination of what we're doing and all the partners that we have working together. It is affordable. We can do this. We can afford it in Madison. We just need to stop focusing on those singular test scores and start focusing on actually educating and supporting children. Our teachers need that because they're getting beat down, too.
Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
First of all, I appreciate your comments. I think mm-hmm. what you're talking about sounds a lot like the community schools model that we are piloting in the Madison School District. It's currently happening at four schools, Leopold, Hawthorne, Mendota, and Lakeview. And it supports educational equity by giving the community a place in our schools to access services and education and programs. I feel like we need to step it up. We're not doing enough with the community schools program, and we're not being thoughtful about how we implement it. We're off to a great start, but I think in a true community schools model, families in the community have opportunities for leadership and a strong voice in making decisions about how schools are run. It's not just about educating families, which is really important.
Yeah.
Also, I feel like we need to think about feeder patterns when we're thinking about community schools. You know, right now kids go to Leopold, and Leopold's a community school, and they have access to dental clinics like you talked about, and they have access to educational programs on parenting and extra reading help. And then they go to Cherokee and it's gone.
Mm.
So if we started being thoughtful about implementing community schools across feeder patterns, we'd actually be able to support kids all their way through MMSD, which is really important if we're going to close gaps. You know, we have kids who are not succeeding at every grade level in our district. And I agree that supporting kids, not just in terms of their test scores, not just in terms of reading and math proficiency, but in terms of everything they need, is going to make a difference in terms of closing gaps.
And you feel like we have the resources in our community to get this as well?
I do. We have to, you know, the community schools model is drawing from a lot of philanthropy. It's not just coming from money that's earmarked from MMSD through state aid and through tax levy. It's also, you know, a philanthropic program where the community has stepped up and is putting money into our schools. And I think, you know, we're not, you know, we have a lot of poverty in our schools, but we're also a well-resourced community. And we're also a community that values education and values children. And I think if we put it out there, the community will continue to step up and ensure that we're supporting our kids.
That's helpful. I like the answers. Much more optimistic than my doomsday questions. Chris, so let's get in some of the nitty-gritty. What are your thoughts? I want to talk about the behavioral education plan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of it. But I think the part of the problem is that there was a hope that it would be successful in and of itself. What are your thoughts on it? Do you think that it is a path to success? Do you think that it is succeeding?
First of all, for a while now, I've served on the Superintendent's Guiding Coalition for the for restorative justice and restorative approaches to behavior.
Great.
So this is an issue I know pretty well. There's been a lot of debate in our community about the BEP since it was implemented about 5 years ago. And I fully support the shift to restorative approaches and the shift away from exclusionary discipline. We can't close gaps in our district if we're excluding kids from school. At the same time, I feel like the BEP was rolled out with great intentions and without the support, you know, and the resources it needed to succeed. And as a result, we've got some serious behavior problems going on in some of our schools, certainly not in all of our schools, but in some of our schools that in some places are pushing our staff and our families close to their limits, if not to their limits. And we need to do something about that. We can't go back to zero tolerance, you know, and expect to close gaps, because if we're just suspending kids, they're not in school, they're not learning. However, if kids are out in the hallway, not in class, they're also not learning. They're excluding themselves. We need to get kids in class, and our classrooms need to be a place where kids can learn. I spent time going to the, there's been an ad hoc committee working on revisions to the behavior education plan, and I've been going to those meetings, and they've had principals and teachers come in and talk about what we need to do as a district to try to make things better. And one suggestion, or, you know, problem that keeps coming up over and over again is the fact that we need more student services support. We need social workers, we need counselors, we need psychologists. We have a lot of vulnerable children in our district with a high level of need, and our staffing doesn't reflect that. The same is true of special education staffing in our district. I've heard from teachers all across the district that we don't have enough special education assistants to implement children's IEPs the way they need to be implemented, and that just breaks my heart. Teachers have also talked about initiative fatigue, which is the fact that the district is throwing a lot at them, and it's very stressful. And a lot of teachers would really just like to focus on learning how to do restorative justice right, learning how to run restorative circles in a way that is truly restorative and builds community in the schools. And I almost feel like, you know, this is one of the most important things we can do to foster equity in our schools and ensure that every child is loved and welcomed and accepted into our school communities, mm-hmm. and that we're giving teachers the support they need to foster that kind of equity in our schools and that kind of acceptance. And if teachers are feeling pulled in too many directions, it's really hard to do that. I do think that the BEP needs to include fair and logical consequences for behaviors, you know, that aren't exclusionary, but that that, you know, if a child doesn't, you know, go to class, maybe they have to make up the work at some point, and, you know, right away. So they know that it's expected that you will do your work and you will go to class. Again, it's not exclusionary. It's helping the child, you know, learn and engage in their work. I also know that with the revisions that are happening with the BEP, there is conversation about trying to have more clarity around things like sexual harassment, sexual assault, and drug and alcohol use in our schools and the consequences for those. And I think that's an important conversation for us to be having.
A couple of thoughts based on what you were just saying. Yeah. And I appreciate everything you said. Mm-hmm. I feel this is the conversation we keep hearing from people that care about our schools. Mm-hmm. We don't have enough social workers. It seems, as someone who doesn't know anything about the details of running a school, it seems like that almost has become a fact. Whether mm-hmm. even if it's not true, that's what you hear nonstop. There's not enough social workers. There's not enough psychologists. There's not enough people. So why don't we have those school resources? And how, when we have leaders on our current school board that care about these issues, but we still don't have enough resources, how can you see changing that when you get on the school board?
It's, I think, a matter of budgeting and, you know, making that staffing a priority when we're coming up with our budgets for our schools. Right now, the staffing just isn't there.
Kaleem, your thoughts on the BEP?
I have a very different view. I don't like the BEP at all. I don't.
Okay.
We're creating plans around challenges that children face when they don't feel loved, cared for, supported, nurtured, and safe. Behavior grows out of something. Sometimes it's very temporary. Every kid gets mad, throws a fit, throws a tantrum. It's part of their development as children. Other children carry the burdens that their families have brought to school with them or brought into their life, or the burdens of their neighborhood or things that have happened, the traumatic experiences in their life. It could be when they're young. It could be when they're older. It could be their own self-doubt, the identity issues that kids face when they're, you know, going through adolescence. And what we've done is we've created a plan that provides all these different measures and punitive measures that I just disagree with. My son, for example, in the Madison schools, he has two different experiences between Jefferson, where he goes to school, and Chavez, where he was at before, both Madison public schools. At Chavez, my son would push his stuff off the table when a teacher asked him a question, and he just didn't want to do it. It got to that point because he has performance anxiety. When he's required to perform in front of everyone and he's not confident, he doesn't want to do it. And if pushed, that's what he did. He would react by pushing things off the table because he knows it's not appropriate to yell or hit or things like that. It was his way of, and he would just shut down. But we worked things out at the school. We kept trying to figure out what do we do, what do we do, what do we do. So on our end, you know, we found we realized what our child's challenge was by addressing the issue at home. But at school, they worked with us where we came in, we got together, and what we realized was if dad comes to school while he has to take a test, I would sit in the counselor's office, just sit there and do my work where he felt comfortable to do his MAP test and things like that, right? Because he didn't want to do it around all the other kids, but he performed very well. It was a very simple thing, and the behavior stopped. The other thing was the teachers realized, too, okay, we can't put this kid on stage in front of everybody because it gets a different reaction, but he can still learn and do everything else in our class. We had a great experience there. Within the first week of school, I get behavior calls about my child. And within the first month of school, I got three. And then I was like every other parent, I just didn't want to pick up the phone from these people anymore, because within all of those phone calls, not once did they tell me how good my child was. They have not, they did not spend much time developing relationships with him at all. And so I looked at that and I said, man, if you would have spent the first month of school really developing relationships with your sixth graders who are new to this brand new environment, making them feel comfortable and good and connected and getting the families connected to each other too, you would have a very different set of circumstances than they have at that school right now. And it's a challenge. So telling people that this plan, I'm like, okay, there's a lot of words on the page. I went to the classes and I saw, went through the plan with everybody. Like, man, we're legislating relationship building.
You know? Is that how you?
That's how I look at it. We're legislating relationship building. You know, we're legislating love and care, basic things that every child should get. And again, I use my school as an example. My teachers know that their primary responsibility is to show love, care, and concern for their children, our families, and each other. That is the foundation of a democracy, of a healthy one. It's a foundation of a healthy school. We also, we have over 70-80% engagement of our parents, and 80% of our parents are low income. So they free and reduced lunch eligible. We have majority of our kids, we have a higher percentage of black kids, I think 65% of our students are African American in our school. And so, but why do we have such high levels of engagement at a school that doesn't even provide busing to families, right? People feel loved and cared for and respected. The parents, I have their own parent committee. We have parents on our board. I have parents who are my boss. So it's a different environment. So when people look at the plan and hiring more social workers, I'm like, great, social workers do a great job. Psychologists do important work. But what about the love, care, and concern we should be showing children within our schools, and also encouraging families to be a part of that as well? And I'm also very serious with our families. I put it on them. When I see stuff that's happening that's not right, I will go to your job. I will go to your home. I will sit down and talk with you. If there's wars going on between mom and dad, we preserve their integrity. We don't talk about it around school. We don't talk about it to their teachers. But we have to solve the fundamental problems that children come to school with. To me, that's more of a holistic type of education where, again, we're looking at the ecosystem that a child grows up in. But if I just start putting social workers and all these people in place, when the real reason why a lot of our kids are struggling behaviorally in school is they don't feel they belong.
So you don't necessarily think we need to add social workers?
Well, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is we're not dealing with the fundamental part of it first. Let's get to know the families. Let's get to know the kids. Let's get to know what's driving their issues in school. If it's a sense of feeling connected, you know, the Tree Lane folks that are coming to our school at Jefferson and all the issues we're dealing with over there, imagine what those children, a lot of them, are bringing to school every day.
Sure, sure. But I would think, you know, Chris,
but it's building a social worker in the school or addressing the fundamental challenges that that family is having in that community, even before we did something that silly, right? Would that help us? So again, we keep bringing new people and new things in before fully assessing what's really needed. So that's what I would want to do, is let's fully assess what's really needed. And that's also ask the teachers.
Chris, do you have, what are your thoughts to some of the things Kaleem said? And I'm not sure they're, at least in my mind, I don't see them as contradictory. I think we can do one thing and still keep the BEP, but I appreciate that's not necessarily what you're saying. Chris, what are your thoughts on?
I agree that I don't think we're actually on too terribly of different pages here. You know, the beginning of the BEP is about how we build those relationships with our students. And then there's like 50 pages of consequences. And I'm with you. Those 50 pages of consequences are confusing and kids don't read them. And kids, it's not actually clear to children what we expect of them.
It's not always clear to parents.
It's not even clear to parents.
Is this a level two or a level three?
And what does that even mean?
I flipped through that when I got a call from Hamilton's middle school one day about my daughter. Right. I was trying to figure it out. Anyhow. Yes.
But that said, I do think that, I agree that building relationships with kids is really important. And I think our teachers are actually working really hard to try to do that, to varying degrees of success in different places. But having listened to principals and teachers come in and talk about the BEP, there are kids in our schools with unmet mental health needs and with unmet social needs that are beyond the capacity of a teacher to just build a loving relationship with them and meet. And that's why we're piloting the Behavioral Health in Schools program and expanding it, I think, this year. And that's a program where we actually bring therapists into schools to talk to kids who need more than what we, who need services from outside, from the community to help them feel, loved and secure and deal with trauma in their lives or deal with whatever they're bringing to school. And that's a program I think we need to expand to all of our schools because, if kids need therapy and they can't access therapy through whatever channels, middle class families do, they should get it. And that is, can help with behavior a huge amount. So I do think there are kids that we need to serve better.
We're talking today, if you're just tuning in, this is I'm Carousel Baird, and we are talking today with Chris Carusi and Kaleem Kerr, two of the candidates that are on the ballot in 2 weeks running for a school board for Madison Metropolitan School Districts. We would love your questions or comments. Love you to join in on the conversation. Give us a call at area code 608-256-2001. You can also send us a tweet at WORT Talk or send us a message on our Facebook page. Our page is A Public Affair 89.9 FM Madison. Kaleem, talk to us about one of the goals of the school district is to have more teachers of color.
Mm-hmm.
How do we retain, recruit, hold on to teachers of color and all teachers? The things that we're talking about are real problems that teachers are the front line. They are working with it. They are doing their best. And they struggle sometimes. How do we retain teachers and how do we expand the racial diversities of our school?
So let me start with the racial diversity part first. Madison, again, people move to the city not just for a job. They'll make a decision to move here because if they have children, it's also a good place to raise their children. It's a good professional step in their career. Maybe there's education they can get here. Maybe it's closer to family. There's all these reasons that people will come. There is a small percentage of African Americans who come, for example, and Latinos that go into education to be teachers. It's less than 6% for each group out of all students that go to get college degrees. So the percentage of children, for example, in our community far exceeds the available pool of teachers of color. Now, that doesn't mean they're not there. That means we have to do a lot of work in order to recruit them here. Madison has had a challenge being a welcoming community of people of color. Even if they do all the work that they do in the school district, when people come here, if they feel isolated, if they feel like there's no place for them to go and hang out and get to know other people like them in this community, if they can't figure out where to get their hair done and nails done and all the things, there'll be barbershops to go to. If there's not a church that they connect with, those are a lot of things that would keep a person here. I believe that for us to really have a very strong recruitment program, we have to involve a lot of key partners in that, and it has to become a core focus, not just of our school district, but of our city leadership. I had thought about running for mayor, and one of the things that I would have done in running for mayor, education would have been number one on my list. And that's one of the things that we would have made a priority, is making sure that there is a way to onboard new families that come to Madison in general, but for African-Americans, Latinos, whoever, people who identify with a specific group, that there would be ways for them to connect into that group when they got here as a means to also retain them. But second, once you get in the schools, what they sold you, you have to actually see. And I know that I've talked to both teachers and principals in the school, teachers of color, white teachers who come here, principals, and they're not feeling that either the community or the district or both are giving them a full, complete picture of what they were walking into. And so, because you go into the Madison schools now, come on, there are some schools, like I just gave you two experiences. One school at Chavez's elementary school, very settling. Our son switched from Leopold his first year, where he was sent to the kitty jail his second or third week of school, and they weren't telling us. He was spending all of his days down there because he was misbehaving. But then he went to Chavez. He didn't do that at all, ever. You know, so you can have these indifferent experiences across schools. But teachers who are there also, they're here and they're seeing this, like, well, what's the plan? What is the focus? So I think that retaining teachers, we have to both invest in their professional growth and development. But like at my school, to retain my teachers, I don't put any pressure on them related to test scores. I was on a panel that advised the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Secretary of Education and the White House on No Child Left Behind. And I saw up close how we were going to require all these things of schools. And then it was all going to narrow the focus on what teachers would be able to teach and be able to do with children that would make education exciting. It all boiled down to this narrow stuff we can test. And then teachers are all held accountable to that. So the stress and the pressure they feel to get it right with kids is enormous.
Are teachers held accountable in MMSD for the test scores in the classroom?
They are. And I'm not sure exactly how. But for us, I know that where my children are, I'm looking at how are you moving as a teacher? What are you doing to help improve your skills, both what we're doing with you and also what you're doing on your own? Are you trying different things in your classroom? We hired you. You're a professional. You're going to make some mistakes. Some program, some activity that you're going to do with kids may not work. But I'm not holding you to that. Oh, it failed today. Well, we're not going to be on track to show these great results. I already showed you we're getting great results without putting that kind of pressure on people. And so we do things to try to love up our teachers. We do special activities after school. We feed our teachers. We do all kinds of things. We try to make sure they're well compensated. And I think our teachers would tell you, my whole staff would tell you that we're not always perfect, but we make a great effort. And so the Madison School District could do this. That's, again, why I'm running for the school board, is I have direct experience with how to make this happen.
Chris, your thoughts on retaining teachers and recruiting teachers of diversity?
I'll start with retaining teachers because Madison has a serious problem with staff retention right now. If you look at the separation numbers, and separation means staff who are leaving MMSD prior to being eligible for retirement.
Okay.
Numbers are 5 times higher now than they were in 2010.
Before Act 10.
Before Act 10 passed. And after Act 10 passed, we saw a huge spike in retirements, and that has kind of leveled off. But since then, we have suddenly, every year, we're seeing staff resignations prior to retirement go up, which to me is an enormous red flag because experienced teachers are an evidence-based strategy to close the achievement gap, as is more teachers of color. And we are losing teachers at all stages of their career, early stage teachers, mid stage teachers, late stage teachers, you know, people with lots of experience, people who are new to the teaching profession, who we also need to be bringing in, are leaving Madison. We're also losing teachers of color.
Are they leaving Wisconsin, do we know, or are they just leaving Madison? Maybe we don't have
those numbers. We don't do exit interviews. Mm. So we actually don't know what's happening after they leave. MTI might do exit interviews, but the district does not. So okay. I know teachers who've left teaching entirely and gone to EPIC. I know teachers who've gone to other districts to teach. So I think it's variable what they're leaving Madison to do, but they're leaving. And we, you know, losing an experienced teacher is devastating to our district. So this is a huge problem we need to take seriously. I have talked with staff about what they think is behind the problem. And two things I'm hearing are, first, the behavior education plan is not being implemented in a way where students can be successful. And the second one is the initiative fatigue I talked about earlier. So much is being thrown at teachers that they don't feel like they can just focus and do their jobs. And it's really stressful. So I think as a school board, we need to start talking about policy and figuring out how we can help boost staff morale by giving them the support they need to do their jobs the best they can and not just throwing things at them from the top and telling them to do it. I know staff would like more say in what their professional development is. I know staff would like more say in how they go about teaching their classes, especially when it comes to presenting a culturally relevant curriculum. our schools are really different. The kids in our schools come from very different cultural and ethnic backgrounds. And yet, increasingly, we're just handing teachers curriculum and saying, this is what you teach on Monday, and this is what you teach on Tuesday. And that doesn't give them a whole lot of flexibility to be responsive both to the cultures and experiences children are bringing to the classroom, which can really make education rich if you allow those cultures to flourish and influence the curriculum. And it's also not allowing teachers to differentiate so that every child feels like they're succeeding every day because what they're learning is appropriate to where they're at, whether they're advanced, you know, right smack in the middle, or need to do some catching up. We need to give our teachers more flexibility and more trust to teach our kids in a way that, you know, they feel empowered. I also think that, you know, we haven't gotten into privatization in charter schools yet, but I do believe in teachers' unions.
Let's talk about that.
And I do believe that it's a benefit for staff to be able to be represented by a union. And that is another piece of staff morale and retention that I think is important, is strong unions.
I want to talk about, you've brought up great points.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris, I want to talk about the classroom.
Yeah.
Everything that you were just talking about. I remember interviewing Jen Cheatham when she was hired, and a conversation that I had in this studio with Jen Cheatham was about how fourth grade in one school is not the same as fourth grade in another, and that there needed to be some unity so that the fourth grade reading level at school X is the same as the fourth grade reading level at school Y, and the math curriculum for second grade at this school is the same as math curriculum, and that the schools were too left to just teach for the community.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciated that, and, you know, nodding along when I was talking with Jen Cheatham, understanding that that didn't seem to make sense, that, right, comparable third graders would be getting different educations. But it seems like we have gone too far, perhaps. I wanted to get your thoughts on that, of saying, you know, is there middle ground? Is there foundation to why school X is different than school Y? Because the kids are different and the needs are different and the experiences of the community is different. And how do you weave that in while still ensuring that everyone in fourth grade at the end knows what multiplication is, or something like that?
First of all, yes. When, you know, I remember when my kids were in elementary school and they moved into middle school at Jefferson, and they suddenly were kids coming from different elementary schools that had different math curricula,
right,
and it was really hard to teach. And so I think getting, you know, curriculum the same across all schools is a good move, but that doesn't mean every child's going to be on the same page on the same day. And that's where I feel like we've gone too far is, you know, I know that we have highly mobile students and that they,
yes,
do need consistency as they move from school to school. That's important. But I do feel like the pendulum has swung too far towards rigidity as opposed to giving teachers some creative freedom to meet the needs of their students and to differentiate instruction. I think that, you know, I'll do reading as an example. The district has implemented a computerized program called Lexia, which is a phonics program, and it's online, and all children do Lexia. They're all supposed to put in Lexia minutes. And for some kids, Lexia is really boring because they know how to read already, but they still have to do their Lexia minutes because that's what the district has said. And other kids would rather be reading books. And for some kids, Lexia is probably working and probably helpful. There's not a whole lot of research that shows that Lexia is actually going to raise the achievement of underperforming students. On top of the fact we're just telling all teachers they have to put in their Lexia minutes, why don't we just let teachers have, you know, a wide range of children's literature and introduce children to different genres? But knowing that we, you know, being very thoughtful about making sure the literature we're giving kids is challenging them and it's, you know, helping them move forward with their reading skills and making it part of, you know, a more responsive reading program that meets the needs of kids and mostly gets them really excited about reading. I just don't see how doing an online phonics program is actually going to get kids excited about picking up books and reading them. And that's where we want to be. We want kids to love learning and love books.
Or Lexia be a tool that teachers can use, but not something that
it's
says you must meet this number.
Yeah. It's for some kids, it may be fabulous. It may actually be meeting a need that they need to meet, but not every child puts in X minutes using this tool, whether or not they need it. So
we've gone structured.
You know, one thing is this challenge as a board member, because board members, our job is not to legislate curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
It is to hire and support superintendent and the plans they put together and question them, but also use the community, and the community includes teachers, to help shape what the strategic direction and the plan is for the school district. And to me, that also means the type of schools we would offer to our children and the type of programs and what level of involvement should teachers have in shaping the curriculum of their classrooms and their schools. You know, I believe if we're treating professionals, regardless of their occupation within the school district, whether they're a classroom teacher, a social worker, custodian, you know, there's a certain amount of professional skill and experience that they bring to the table, whether they've been there 1 year or they've been there 20. And, you know, I think that we've got to find ways to take advantage of both their passion and interest to be in the field and their background and experience to be in it as well to create these schools of the future. We have an expeditionary learning model in our school for our kindergarten. And as we grow to sixth grade, that's the program we'll use. But the way our teachers are engaging in that, we're sending them to visit different schools for themselves to see how things are happening, to come back with their ideas. We just shaped our habits of character with our own whole school, got involved in that. What should our habits of character be? You know, our kids have played a role in shaping that. And so our people feel good about coming to work every day because they're about building this program. But beyond that, Madison schools and other school districts around the country, while we have this standardization of curriculum, was largely driven by the fact that one group or two groups or small number of kids weren't getting what they needed.
Right.
Schools worked for the advantaged kids. And that was the Madison School District. It was, you know, it was the Russian roulette choice of teachers. So sure. If I knew, and I was a part of the connected group, and I knew what teacher to sign my kid up for at West High School or at Van Heist Elementary, then all of us would talk about it, and we'd make sure our kids got in that class with that particular teacher.
My kids are at Van Heist. How do we get that? I never got to pick the teacher.
But here's the point, though. Here's the point, though, is that
I don't know that
matters. That's the way the system works. So Jen Cheatham, I think, did a great job of saying, wait a minute, guys, we got to get a baseline. We got to create a baseline, and that's what it is. But the other thing is, to turn the Titanic of the Madison School District in a direction that it needs to go, regardless if we agree with that direction or not, it is a heavy lift. There are a lot of people, families, children, staff that have to be involved in that. You will not see great results when you make a big change like that. Your results will go down. All research shows that. And then it'll come back up because people have to get used to the new way of doing things.
That's tricky, though.
But we don't talk about that. We don't have these kinds of conversations.
The learning curve of things,
but it's tricky. There is going to
be
time. So what should our expectations be as we make that change? I don't think we're clear about setting that expectation as a board, as a community.
How long do you follow something through before you decide?
How long will they take?
It's tricky. I appreciate that. We only have a few more minutes. I do want to talk about voucher schools. I appreciate Chris bringing it up.
About what schools?
Voucher schools. Voucher schools and private schools.
We don't have voucher schools in the public school system.
Well, what do we have in Madison? We have charter schools.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about the variety of the different schools. Mm-hmm. That there is a voucher school in MMS in the city of Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Is there only one now? There
only
used to
one.
Be two in Dane County, but only one.
I know about the one in
Fountain
Madison.
Of Light.
Just one in MMSD.
What impact is that? How important is it? Is it a threat to MMSD? Is it a compliment to MMSD? Private charters versus public charters? I know that One City School, you applied to be a public charter. I don't want to get into the debate of why it did or didn't happen, but applied to be a public charter wasn't granted.
Well, I think we have to say that. And this is my opportunity to tell people that.
Well, okay, but we're in our final moments here.
Well, really? Yeah.
I'm asking you a big question.
Yeah,
moments
to
go.
You asked
okay,
it.
Okay.
We first offered Madison Prep when I was at the Urban League to be a public school. It was our superintendent, Dan Nierad, who said he didn't think it would work. So as a person who's been working on this for 25 years and come from a family that's been working on 50 years or more on education issues to bring our kids level with other students in the school district, my question continues to be to people, how long are we supposed to wait? And I asked this of the teachers union, who I support. I told you, I support teachers unions. I used to be a member of MTI, and they supported me in 1998 when I ran for school board. They endorsed me. That hasn't changed. But I've embraced a model of education that some of them don't support, which I get. But I've said to people is that if the school district tells us no, but we believe that this will work for our children, mm-hmm. and I have data to show that my children are outperforming the schools already, then why wouldn't I choose it? And so, but what I am concerned about is charter schools were meant to be public schools that are innovative and that we could learn from, and that we would use them to actually bring innovations back into the school district. The first big supporter of charter schools is Al Shanker, who used to be the head of American Federation of Teachers. But he didn't like it when Minnesota decided to, when they were the first person to implement a charter law, when they decided to go back to the legislature as a Democratic body and say, you know what, we're also going to allow non-teachers to actually start schools. That's when he broke with the whole idea of charter schools.
Okay.
So, but here's my point, though, is that our job at One City is to try to be an innovative model. And what I'm doing is the reason why I'm running for school board. I have no intention of developing a whole parallel universe of public schools in Madison. My interest continues to be going on close to 30 years now, trying to do something within the Madison public school system. Other things, like I told you, Nuestro Mundo, mm-hmm. Schools of Hope, other people have tried, but we haven't tried as a real systemic effort to create the change that all of us could be involved in, community teachers. And I've figured out a way to do this, and I think I could be helpful as a member of the school board, utilizing what also we are learning from our charter to help.
I want to give Chris mm-hmm. a few moments to comment on this, yeah. too. Thank sure. you, Kaleem. Mm-hmm. Chris.
Okay, so I just want to put out there that I support public funds going to public schools that are publicly governed by elected school boards. And there's different kinds of charter schools. We have charter schools in the Madison School District that fit that description. But One City and other schools that have been authorized by the UW system and not by our district are publicly funded, but they're not publicly governed. The transparency isn't there. And furthermore, you know, our tax dollars are going to out of our public schools, which still have the same need, into choice schools, which reduces the resources that we have available for the kids in our public schools. I firmly believe that these choice schools actually take choices away from families in our public schools by reducing the resources we have available in those schools, and that every student should have the choice of attending an excellent public school in their neighborhood. You shouldn't have to go to a charter school to get a really great education. And so I'm running for the school board because I want to fulfill that vision. I want to make sure that every single child in Madison has the option to go to a really great public school that is in their neighborhood. We're not there yet. We've got a long way to go. But, yeah.
I know we can tell. I mean, I want to have a whole separate show of about the conversation of public versus private charter schools.
There's
about,
no such thing as a private charter school.
Okay.
They're all public schools.
Okay. Gotcha.
I keep telling people that there are private.
Gotcha.
There are private schools that are participating in the voucher program.
But the charter schools are public.
We're held to
but
a
not
higher
instrumentalities
level
of MMSD.
We're held
but
to
still
a higher
public.
Level degree of public accountability. If we don't reach our benchmarks, which are right here, in 5 years, they can shut us down.
Okay.
There's no public school in Madison that is closed because black children, only 7 to 9% of them have been reading at grade level for the last 20, 30 years.
I mean, I think that's part of the conversation is, you know, why do people choose other schools? Because they're not satisfied with what they're seeing.
Correct.
And what's the best way to move that forward?
And I'm worried that people are going to want to come to my school. And we'll end up having this pressure to create a whole parallel path of schools. I don't want that.
That's not what you want. Okay.
What I want is Madison, finally, please, I keep begging you for 30 years, give me a chance to participate within the public schools that I'm also a taxpayer and help pay for. Let me help by bringing these innovations within the school district. And I asked the teachers, you know, why do people keep saying no?
In our final moments here, then.
It's not like I don't support them.
Talk to me. Well, talk to me. Let me give you both 20 seconds for sort of your final statements and final pitches and how people can learn more about your campaign mm-hmm. and get involved. Chris?
You can learn more about my campaign at chrisforschools.com. We welcome volunteers. We're knocking on so many doors, and it's really fun, and I hope people will come out and volunteer with us. You know, like I said at the beginning, I've been attending school board meetings for a really long time. I've been listening to people for a really long time. And part of the excitement of running a school board campaign is it's an opportunity to listen to more people. So I'm looking forward to that in the campaign. I hope people will volunteer.
Thanks, Chris. Kaleem, final moments.
Go to careforkids.com, C-A-I-R-E, number 4kids.com. You can read more about me, more about the agenda that I'm pursuing with a member of the school board. But I hope people come out and vote in the primary on February 19th.
In 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And April 2nd.
The general election,
to this
too.
And, You know, it's going to be a good time.
I want to thank you both for joining me.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Kaleem. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great day, and we'll see you again next week.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters on Politics. On today's show,
there's a political agenda in Nietzsche. There's a political project to overturn the whole dispensation that has been dominant since the French Revolution and return to ideas of radical hierarchy. We live in a world where the weak are dominating the strong, and that's perverse, it's anti-natural, and it's the destruction of true greatness. When Richard Spencer reads these texts, it's a kind of magic.
A conversation on two influential and legendary philosophers, Friedrich Nietzsche and Martin Heidegger, and the influence that their work has had on the modern-day alt-right. Our guest for this conversation is Ronald Biener. Ronald Biener is a professor of political science at the University of Toronto, and he is the author of the book Dangerous Minds, Nietzsche, Heidegger, and the Return of the Far Right. That's next on Letters on Politics. But first, the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. Russia has announced plans to develop new land-based missile systems in response to US decision to abandon an arms control treaty. Moscow has also pulled out of the Intermediate Range Pact, raising fears of a new arms race. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
The US says Russia already has land-based cruise missiles, the reason why Washington said it was pulling out of the INF treaty. But Moscow's latest announcement will add to the concerns of a new arms race. Russia's defence minister said work will begin.